Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the good folks from Teatro Paraguas. Right now, I'd like to welcome Dr. Yolanda Briscoe. She is the executive and clinical director of the Santa Fe Recovery Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is Recovery Week. It's, a Santa Fe Recovery Week or New Mexico?
It's Recovery Week, the whole nation.
Okay.
And but for the purposes of Santa Fe, this is going to be a Santa Fe Recovery Week hosted by the Santa Fe Recovery Center. There's been a proclamation issued by the governor proclaiming Santa Fe, proclaiming Recovery Week this week, and also Mayor Koss has issued a proclamation proclaiming this week officially Recovery Week.
So what is it that people are recovering from at the Recovery Center?
From drugs and alcohol addiction. Recovery can also mean recovery from mental health issues, but for purposes of this week and the work that we do, it's for drugs and alcohol.
So it's really so-called substance abuse.
Yes.
So when people go into a recovery center like Santa Fe Recovery Center, is this a in-house inpatient treatment program?
Well, we have different options depending on the level of severity. We will do an assessment to determine the level of care. Somebody who comes into our treatment facility may be needing residential treatment, which is for 30 days, or may benefit from our outpatient services. We have a facility in Santa Fe and one in Española.
So what are people's lives like that tend to get them to the point where they check into a recovery center? I mean, we hear this thing about hitting bottom, you know, in the 12, yeah. That's a term that I guess they use in 12-step programs.
You don't necessarily have to hit bottom to seek treatment. Your life can be completely out of control, or you may have already received a couple of DWIs, or maybe you're noticing that you're missing work because you're drinking too much, or you're using every day, and it has become that you're dependent on it and not just abusing it. And so you may say, you know what, I want a change in my life. So it doesn't have to be where you're sitting in a jail cell or everything's lost and your whole family's gone, where that you need to come seek treatment.
What are the conditions in people's lives that lead them to substance abuse in the first place that you see?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. There isn't just one reason. Somebody struggling with drugs and alcohol, it can be somebody who started out just having a good time and ended up using the drugs or the alcohol as a way of coping, or it could be maybe a way of dealing with social anxiety. It may have been a way to deal with pain. We have individuals who started out using painkillers because they had pain, ended up abusing and then becoming dependent on painkillers. So there's a variety of ways to get to that point where you're struggling with addictions.
And there's also, of course, issues of difficulties in people's lives where they, instead of dealing with the difficulties or they're too hard to deal with or whatever, they drown their sorrows or self-medicate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I have found in working in addictions is that the majority of people that we work with are, by and large, quite sensitive individuals, which is why I love doing the work that I do, because I am able to be in the company of individuals who are, in general, quite sensitive. And one of the ways of dealing with difficult emotions is using a substance so that you don't have to feel, because, well, nobody wants to feel ugly or awful or sad or depressed. Nobody wants to feel grief. Would rather just not feel it. And if you're someone who struggles with your feelings, then drugs or alcohol can be a way of not having to deal with your feelings.
So when people come in for treatment, there is, and I've seen this in people who are struggling with addictions in one way or another, whether it's alcohol or something else, they sometimes know they have a problem, But then, no, they don't. You know, they don't want to deal with it. And so they want to deal with it, and they don't want to deal with it. And there's this sort of back and forth conflict. Mm-hmm. There that person is surrounded by therapists and helping people. How do you deal with people who are in that state of ambivalence?
And that's a good word, ambivalence. We used to use the word denial. The individual was in denial. There's something called motivational interviewing where you work with an individual to help them to see that, okay, so what you're saying is that you're really not struggling with alcohol, but you've already received 3 DWIs, and let's talk about that. So it's a gentle way of dealing with the ambivalence in a way that is non-confrontational and non-punitive and non-shaming.
Are people who were in that situation, I would imagine that there's been quite a bit of punishment and shaming in their lives already.
Yes, absolutely. And punishment does not work. If punishment worked, you could put somebody in jail and they would come out and say, okay, I've seen the light, I'll never drink again. That's just not how it works. You could
right.
have
jail does not make you into a Boy Scout.
No. In fact, you can actually continue to use and drink while you are imprisoned or in jail.
There are some states that have actually passed laws that require treatment rather than incarceration for people who are found guilty of nonviolent drug offenses.
Yes. One of those states being New York that comes to mind, that have been quite successful in having people seek treatment because, again, going to jail or being imprisoned doesn't help. I read an article the other day that 80% of the women in prison are in prison because of drug-related crimes, and the crime being that you turned up dirty on your UA and so you had to...
What's a UA?
Urine analysis.
Right.
That you turned up dirty and so you had to... You were put back in jail for abusing or that's just not the way that you treat addictions.
It's funny, I was thinking about that. If somebody is found guilty of drug possession, it doesn't mean that they should be incarcerated. It also doesn't mean that they're an addict.
No, it does not. Somebody could be abusing drugs or alcohol and have to go to jail for an abuse issue versus a dependence. So we continue to build more jails, we continue to build more prisons, because individuals think that judges and legislators and lawmakers feel that we need to put these, quote-unquote, these people behind bars and have the streets safe for society, just get them off the streets. Well, we keep building more and more prisons, and we're not addressing the issue of addiction, or more specifically, dependence.
When people say, when you hear that term, these people, there's often a prejudicial or racial tinge or a class tinge to it.
Absolutely. Anytime you actually use the word they or them or those people, you are making a general statement about a population. And there are, so that is racist, prejudicial statement.
Or can be, and that mm-hmm. and that plays a role in this whole conversation. We're talking to Dr. Yolanda Briscoe of the Santa Fe Recovery Center, and ladies and gentlemen, we are right in the middle of Recovery Week. What is the rate of success in recovery for people who make the decision that they want to recover? I know that for some people, they try, they give it a good shot, doesn't work.
There can be multiple attempts at recovery. For some people, right away. Others, it's more of a process. There isn't good data. In fact, if you Google to try to find out what the percentages are, you would have a really hard time coming up with a number. What we're doing at the Recovery Center is we have an individual doing follow-up and getting data. The preliminary data was 60% were staying clean and sober. That's really high. Now what we're looking at is not only have they stopped drinking or using, but we're looking at have they had any hospital visits? Have they used emergency services? Have they continued to work? Because there are other factors that can be quite positive in that recovery. So maybe you had a relapse and you drank one night. But you didn't go to the emergency, so that's saving taxpayer dollars. You didn't miss any work. You were not in any kind of accidents. You maintained your job. So there are other variables that will show a success that may not necessarily mean that they have completely stayed clean during that time.
Interesting. Now, the whole question of taxpayer dollars, again, comes into this question of how does society treat people with substance problems? I guess it turns out that incarcerating people is a lot more expensive than treating them.
Yes, it is. It's $8 to one that you.
Is that right?
You know, it's really expensive to incarcerate somebody, and they're not receiving treatment while they are. By and large, now there are some prisons and jails that do offer treatment, but by and large, someone is sitting there and being punished for something that isn't going to change with punishment.
It's interesting also, I mean, the 8 to 1, I don't know if that factors in the reality that when a person is done with treatment, they can actually become a productive taxpaying member of society.
Exactly. But the knee-jerk reaction of when tragedy occurs and there's death, then the impulse is to, we need to make tighter laws, we need to have longer stays of punishment. It's all punitive. Instead of looking at what are we going to do to treat the individual, what are we going to do to address the dependence versus treating individuals who are abusing drugs or alcohol and putting them behind bars because we want to keep, you know, nobody wants to be accused of being quote-unquote soft on crime. And so the impulse is to just make more laws, become stricter about the laws that we have versus looking at how are we going to support the treatment, the providers that are struggling to stay afloat, and what are we going to do to help individuals who can't afford treatment? What are we going to do to help them get treatment?
And just the big question of what is the most effective way of dealing with this problem?
Well, at the Recovery Center, what we do is we use everything that's been researched. We do evidence-based practices to where the work that we do is work that's, it's not something we just figured, hey, well, let's try this or let's try that. We provide a model that's been researched and found to be effective, such as the motivational interviewing, 12-step program, community reinforcement and family treatment, cognitive behavioral. And so the listener listening to that, well, what's all that? You know, it just sounds like, you know, what bottom line, what kind of treatment am I going to get? And we're very proud to say that we have a very compassionate program. It's non-punitive. We're not going to try to shame anybody or bring them down. It's building somebody up and also becoming more self-sufficient, working on strengths. And it's a very, it's a place that miracles happen at the Recovery Center. People come in and I hear over and over again that they get a sense that it's a inviting, it's warm, and it's a compassionate place.
Do you have therapists or other people working there who themselves have been through recovery? I would imagine that plays a big role in a kind of role model sense.
Yes. We have individuals who have struggled with drugs and alcohol themselves who are in recovery, and we have individuals who are not. And that works because there's a balance. We have a balance of individuals who care about, bottom line is they care about the clients, they care about the people they work with. In fact, administration, nobody in administration is in recovery, but we're individuals who have a sense of calling of helping other people who are struggling. And again, like I said at the beginning, that I'm just continuously humbled by the individuals I get to meet because it's just by and large wonderful, wonderful human beings who just happen to have a problem with drugs or alcohol.
What are the substances, quote unquote, that you see are the most actually damaging, you know, to the brain, like on a physiological level? And that makes it harder for people in the future, even if they do recover.
Oh, that would be like methamphetamine does a lot of damage to the brain, does damage to the body, does damage to the teeth and the skin. So it's more visible. But I think that still the number one problem is still alcohol, because even the detox is different. You can die from detoxing from alcohol, and the drunk drivers and loss of income and visits to the emergency department at the hospital. So I think still alcohol is the biggest problem.
Isn't that interesting? Uh-huh. It's the one legal drug
exactly.
that's the most... How do you
exactly.
feel about... We've talked about drug legalization quite a bit on this program. How do you weigh in on that?
Well, I feel that people going into jail for doing something that they're dependent on is personally, I'm not speaking for the recovery center, but just on a personal level, I think it's pretty ridiculous. They ought to be getting treatment. And like you said, alcohol being a legal drug, cigarettes being a legal drug, more people die from cigarette-related illnesses than all of the other drugs and alcohol combined.
Is that right?
And yet we continue to, not me, but we, you know, individuals continue to smoke, and it's okay. And then you'll have somebody who is struggling with an opioid addiction or heroin, and ooh, that drug addict, and society looks down upon them as they smoke their cigarette, drink their coffee, and have a nightcap every night. And so those sorts of things are going to kill you just like the heroin will. But there's a lot of stigma, and that's one of the challenges that I have personally as a director and trying to find funding. There's a lot of stigma around. I myself had them. I'd never want to work with drug addicts and alcoholics because I had a fear and had no understanding of the population, and so it's difficult to get funding because they just need to get their life together. You know, well, I quit. Why don't they?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. How did you get into this?
I got into it working in San Francisco. I lived in San Francisco and worked for as a program director for a women's residential treatment. And that's where I realized that the people I was going to be working with, by and large, of course, it's a generalization, were just really remarkable individuals who just happened to have a substance abuse problem, who were otherwise, you know, could be great moms. It was a women's treatment facility. And then came to move to this area and fortunately was able to come to work for an organization that has a board of directors that's very supportive and a community that really embraces a strong AA and NA community that's very supportive.
Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous.
Yes.
Okay. Now, AA and NA and all the different 12-step programs are based on a spiritual model on one level. For people who don't relate to spirituality, is it harder for them to recover, or is there another way to use those programs without the higher power concept?
Well, somebody coming into the facility who says, I don't want to hear anything about Jesus, God, or any kind of religion, I'm not interested, don't try to change my way. We ask that they at least be open to a spiritual component of their recovery. We ask that they at least listen and be respectful of what is going on there. 9 times out of 10, they will find some spiritual, whether it be through Buddha or Jesus, God, their way of seeing, finding their higher power. They are able to do that, find their own. We don't say this is how it's got to be. You have to be a Christian or you're not going to get into, you're not going to, or you're not going to graduate. Now, we do encourage finding a sponsor before they leave, because we think that having supports when you leave is really important. We have individuals for 30 days and the community has them for the rest of their life. So we try to find supports for individuals while they're in treatment.
We're talking to Dr. Yolanda Briscoe, who is the executive and clinical director of the Santa Fe Recovery Center. So Recovery Week is what we're in the middle of right now. And then this coming Saturday is the 3rd annual Recovery Week celebration. And is it right on the plaza in Santa Fe?
Yes, it is.
And so it's a Saturday from 10 to 4. There's going to be all sorts of music, Agua Bendita, Bill Hearn, Dean Station, El Mariachi Encantado, and many more. And also Reverend Hector and the Recovery Band. What's that all about?
Well, the whole day is filled with very talented individuals. It's also free, which is really exciting because you can go out and bring your family and enjoy music and entertainment and get information about the services all around Santa Fe. It's not just the recovery center that will be there. It will be area providers and providers from up north as well. So we're trying to be really inclusive and invite everybody to come out because everybody will always have clients. We don't need to really be protective of our territory.
Yeah, right.
There's plenty of clients for everyone. And if somebody receives help, whether it's from us or from LifeLink or Ayudantes or wherever, as long as the individual gets recovery, it's better for everyone.
What happens in more rural areas where there's not as much access to the kind of treatment that we have here in a city?
It's a real challenge. We have individuals who come in from maybe Raton or Cuba or small towns, Wagon Mound, New Mexico, and then go back into areas that don't have a whole lot of support. It is a definite challenge. One of the things that in our long-term plans, and we're working on actually right now, is working on supportive housing so that we can have a community where our facility is now, where somebody can come in and get residential treatment, transition to outpatient, and live in an environment that's supportive of recovery. A lot of our clients who come in don't have a supportive environment to go back to. They're going back to the environment that got them there in the first place. So having supportive housing, employment and housing are the cornerstone for recovery. And if you don't have those two, the odds are stacked against you.
Yeah, and in a rural area where there's not as many choices. I mean, if you live in a city, even a small city like Santa Fe, and you want to change your life, you can really pretty much get rid of your whole set of friends who weren't really supportive of you and get a whole new set of friends. But you can't do that in a town of 700 people.
Right. Yes, it is more of a challenge. It can be done, but if we had some supportive housing where somebody could have more than 30 days, could stay in that housing as long as they needed to get back on their feet and make some real positive and significant changes in their life would be ideal. And we're working on that.
So how do you and the other people who are working at the Santa Fe Recovery Center keep yourselves sane and positive and all of that in the face of what are probably more horror stories than most of us see in a year?
Well, we have a really tight and very supportive, nurturing, loving staff. We have, I just got back from our clinical staff meeting right now, and we mix laughter in there. We joke with one another, and we try to keep it light. It's the hour when you can come in and you can just relax because it's intense work. For the individuals who are in recovery, they're very strong in the 12-step community, and whether it be NAAA, CA, that's one form.
NAA what?
NA, Narcotics Anonymous, or CA, Cocaine Anonymous.
Oh, there's a cocaine one, okay.
Yeah. And so I think just supporting each other is really important, and trusting that all of us are there for the same thing, to all help the clients. Maybe we do it a little different, but the bottom line is that we're all there to help.
What do you do for fun to get away from it all?
I have a grandson that brings me great joy, my kids, family, friends, my dogs.
Right.
Living out in the country. There's quite a few things that I do for enjoyment.
If somebody has a loved one, a brother, sister, husband, wife, friend, whatever, who they see has a problem, and that person kind of knows they have a problem, kind of doesn't, what is the role of that family member or friend in helping that person to recover? On the one hand, you can't do it for them. On the other hand, what can you do?
Well, you can also ask them to call the recovery center, and we can do an assessment. We can do a screening that doesn't cost anything. They can come in and just see if, in fact, they do have a problem. We like to be supportive of the whole family. We have Dr. Bea Lumen. She's our family therapist, and she helps the entire family. So we do think that it's not just an individual problem. It is a family problem, and so we're there to support the family.
And so all sorts of therapy are going on there, including family therapy. And this weekend is on the plaza, the Well, they're calling it the last free music festival of the year, but it's the Santa Fe Recovery Center Path to Recovery third annual Recovery Week celebration. Once again, 10 to 4 on the plaza, and people can just go and have a good time, and if they need it or are interested or just want to gather information, find out a whole lot about recovery.
Yeah, please join us.
Dr. Yolanda Briscoe, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And the Santa Fe Recovery Center can be found on the web.
Yes, www.sfrecovery.org. It is going through a major restructuring the website, but go on it now, and you should be seeing a new one within a few weeks. So thank you very much. You can also call us at 505-471-4985. And anyone who answers the phone can direct you to somebody who can help you navigate the system. It's not an easy process, but it's a process that's well worth it.
Dr. Yolanda, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment with Teatro Paraguas. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Argos McCallum, Jojo Sena de Tarnoff, and Mary Meir, who are all with Teatro Paraguas. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello. Thank you
for having us.
So we have had Teatro Paraguas on the air quite a number of times before, but Argos, for those who don't know the group, tell us a little bit about what this theater company does.
Well, Teatro Paraguas does bilingual theater here in Santa Fe. We've been going since 2004. We've done about 16 or 17 shows, mainly at El Museo, but various other venues as well. We're kind of a colectiva of theater artists. We have interest in poetry and drama and music. We've done a number of original shows, about 9 original shows, and we've just got our own home, our own little warehouse, which we're turning into a theater, a small studio theater, which is also where we will be building our sets and rehearsing. And
that's quite an accomplishment.
Well, we're very happy to have gotten this far.
Where is it?
We're over in what's becoming fast known as the South Side Theater District. We're over near Home Depot, but we are neighbors to Theater Work, another group here in town that's been going for 12 years. And Wise Fool is around the corner. They're very famous, I'm sure listeners know Wise Fool.
Trapeze and scarves and clowning and all sorts of good
things. That's right.
So this whole concept of bilingual theater, there are bilingual people in Santa Fe, and there's probably more of them in Santa Fe, Spanish and English, than in most places. But at the same time, the vast majority of theater goers are more, monolingual English?
Well, I guess it could be characterized like that, but I think the thing is that those who have Spanish as their first language perhaps have not had the opportunity or the no company has dedicated themselves to doing theater that's bilingual. And so
you found there's an audience.
Yes, we are developing an audience. We've kind of found our own niche here in the theater scene of Santa Fe.
And we're actually getting more and more of the natives involved, it seems like, that did not know that we had a bilingual theater company. So I think more and more, as they're finding out, they're starting to come out of their, because the natives don't really go to the theater, the natives I'm talking about, like the ones that have been here since the 1600s,
But so-called Hispanic Santa
yes,
Fe.
Yes, which I am one of. And we have a few other members that are also natives of Santa Fe. And the more and more we're getting word out to our families and our relatives, they're starting to figure out, there's a place for us to go now. So that audience is also coming to us too, I think.
What is the prevalence of Spanish speaking at this point in that native population that's been here since the 1600s? I know that Spanish was kind of stamped out for a while,
yes.
But then there was a resurgence.
And I'm one of those victims, actually. My generation, when I was a little girl, we all spoke Spanish. My mom's family, my dad, everybody, they all speak fluent Spanish. And when I was young, apparently, I did as well. But as we got put into school, especially public school, we were told no Spanish. It's, you got to be English speaking. So
in the school system, particularly.
Yes. So unfortunately, many of us, which I've talked to recently too, really are having a hard time with it now that we weren't able to keep up. You know, so therefore, me being involved in the bilingual theater is helping me to get back to that. And so the older Spanish speaking are loving it, and the ones my age are loving it because it is bilingual. And, you know, they could be.
There's a real resurgence in the language. We just did a performance at the 400 on Marcy
the
Park.
The 400th anniversary of Santa Fe.
And while there, I was walking around, and there was a wonderful project that the Poet Laureate of Santa Fe had started, which is about family circles. And I talked to one of the women there, and they have started a circle. She was a principal at a high school here. She started a woman's circle where they are speaking Spanish. Mm-hmm. She said she didn't have it. And now that she wanted to learn it. So there is a real impetus to get it back and to, you know, intelligent groups getting together to make sure it's not lost.
And, of course, Teatro Paraguas is doing plays and readings and so on that are of particular interest to the local community. For example, the stage reading of Robert Benjamin's play, Parted Waters, is coming up not this Friday, but the next one, Friday this 25th of September, at this new studio, which we'll give the address of it at the end. Mm-hmm. And that is about the whole question of crypto-Jewish identity in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's an issue that's becoming very popular. People are exploring it at the moment. It's estimated that 1 in 10 people in northern New Mexico are descended from crypto-Jewish ancestors.
Jojo Sena de Tarnoff is pointing at herself.
Pretty sure we were too.
Are you just outing yourself?
No, I'm just because we were. I was just having this conversation with my Jewish husband, and he's a Russian Jew. But he was. We were looking that up, and we're thinking pretty much our families do come from that sort of situation.
Yeah, the Jews, of course, during the Inquisition in Spain, a lot of them converted in order to escape being put to death, and a lot of them also then emigrated to the New World. And when the Inquisition showed up in Mexico City, you know, they came further north, trying to hide their identity as crypto-Jews. And I understand from Robert Benjamin that the Inquisition never even got to Santa Fe in the year 1662, mm-hmm. and had some trials. So it's a history that is ripe for being explored at this point.
And this play does so. Do you want to tell us, without giving too much away, do you want to tell us a little bit about the play?
Well, it concerns three generations of Hispanic men. The grandfather's still on the farm up north. The father is working for Intel in Albuquerque. The son is running for state office against a Jewish woman who's his opponent. Her daughter is actually Miguel's campaign manager, and an unintended slur during the campaign, during a debate, kind of triggers this avalanche of the revelation of the fact that the family is crypto-Jewish. Even within the family, certain members knew and certain members didn't. That's how volatile an issue it really is. And Robert's play was commissioned by the Arizona Jewish Theater and performed last year. He's had a number of readings in Albuquerque here and in Arizona. And it's quite a very strong play.
Now, Jojo, when you just were saying that this is something that you're looking into, how did the questions of identity are something that people talk about just endlessly, this whole sense of who I am, which is something that everybody tries to spend their whole life figuring out, and nobody ever knows who they are anyway.
Sure.
But what does it mean to you if that's true, if you have this crypto-Jewish background? Does it change the way you live, the way you think about yourself?
I don't think so. It's just kind of exciting to know, because I didn't know that, you know, in the first place. But I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think it changes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, this play, Parted Waters, is a staged reading. Are all of you in it?
No, the actors are Angelo Jaramillo, Tom Romero, Lisa Friedland, and myself. and it's being directed by Fran Martone.
And so a staged reading means they have the scripts in their hands, but they're acting.
That's right. We're working with a certain number of props, and we have the script in our hand, but we have it rehearsed to the point where we really know what we're doing. It's not just a cold, dry reading. We're moving about on the stage.
And this will presumably be actually stages of full-on play at some point.
Teatro Paraguas is looking at it for a possible spring production.
Meanwhile, the next day, Saturday, September 26th at 7:30, and the 27th, Saturday and Sunday afternoon, is another piece, and that is Para Que Yo Me Llame Ángel González. That's a play. Is it a play or is it a reading of poetry?
We've always had a little trouble describing what we do because we memorize the poems and then we use our actor skills to really explore the meaning of the poem. Ángel González is a Spanish poet. He actually died last year, but he's quite well known in Spain. He grew up under Franco. When he died last year, every newspaper in Spain published his poems. He's very popular with the younger generation in Spain. And his widow, Susana Rivera, is a native of Santa Fe. Ángel González was a professor of literature at UNM from 1973 to 1994. And after he retired, he married his student, Susana Rivera. And she is now herself a professor of Spanish literature at UNM.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So Ángel González, when you read, so you're going to be basically having actors read his poetry.
Well, they haven't memorized, and so we're doing a little bit of recite. There we go. We're doing some minimal staging. We also have the guitar of David Briggs accompanying the actors, and Susanna Garrett will be doing some flamenco dancing as well. Ángel González was a great fan of flamenco and would hang out in the bars all night reciting poetry and watching dancing and having a great time.
When you read poetry in this way or recite poetry in this way, do you do the English first and then the Spanish or vice versa?
Well, primarily we're reading the Spanish. We're reciting the Spanish and we're projecting the English translations.
Oh, interesting.
There are a few of the poems where
it's almost like subtitles. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. There are a few where we interweave the English and Spanish just because, in Angel's case, the poems are very dramatic. They tell a story. And he has a very dry, facile wit concerning what it means to be alive, the nature of time, and the nature of love. And he's...
That kind of covers a lot of ground right there.
Yeah, well, Spanish poets do tend to do that. So
they're very dramatic.
Yeah.
We're talking to Argos McCallum, Jojo Sena de Tarnoff, and Mary Mir from Teatro Paraguas. So those are two of the projects. You also have another thing going on, which we will let people know when it actually is going to happen. It may or may not be happening very soon, but it's called Cuentos de mi Gente, Stories of My People. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, this is wonderful because most of our cast is our young adult, the A-team, we call them. They've been with us a couple of years now, so they're growing as they are in the theater company, and more of them want to, I want to be in the show. So normally the cuentos, we put in the young adults, most of the young adults, into the cuentos, because those are fun, those are stories. And one of them, Patricia Crespin, who was also the director of WAHA, We Are Hispanic American Women.
The author.
Right.
Thank you, Mary. Wrote a cuentos called Tres Pigletitas y Diablo the Wolf. And, of course, translated, that's The Three Little Pigs and the Wolf. But the story is about, now I know it through my mom and through her sisters, that this story happened at the line camp in Tezuque. I don't know if you know where that, it's a, what's it called now, Mary?
It's,
It was a famous
It's a gallery now, isn't it?
It's a gallery now, but it's there in Pahuaque, right as you get into Pahuaque. Right on the left-hand side. And it used to be called the Lion Camp, and everybody used to go dancing there. Everybody used to go. But there's a story, with the Catholics, we have Lent. And in Lent, you can't really go out and do things. You need to really concentrate on yourselves. And the story goes that, I don't know if it was an aunt or a cousin or something, but one of the girls or a couple of the girls in the family decided they were going to sneak out on Good Friday and go to this dance. And, they weren't, the mother and everybody, no, you can't go out in Lent, it's wrong, it's a sin, you can't do it, and so they sneak away and they go to the dance and apparently meet into the devil and scare them, and it's a whole story about that.
Well, what do you expect if you go out during
I know it, see? And so we've intertwined, Patricia's intertwined it with the Three Little Pigs and the Wolf, and it's very moch. I don't know if you know what that means, but very... Zoot Suit. I don't know if anyone's seen that movie, but,
like 40s style?
Yeah. With Orale, and the whole thing like this with the suit, and the wolf is real, and the three girls are the pigs, and so it's really, really, really cute, and that's going to be our first story. You want to talk about the other two?
Oh, well, some of the cuentos in our repertoire, we've done now three productions of cuentos. Another one is Encaje y Espuma, The Good Sister and the Bad Sister. It's kind of a what they call a morales.
They're all morality tales so far.
Yeah. And then
things you tell your kids to try to get them to behave well.
Exactly.
And then Joe Hayes gave us permission to stage his story. It's not his story. It's originally a Russian story, but he's made it popular in the area. The Day It Snowed Tortillas. So we have that on the bill as well.
Which, by the way, we should say we are performing those two cuentos this weekend in Las Golondrinas for the Renaissance Fair.
To raise money for Open Hands, the Renaissance Fair that's at Las Golondrinas.
Excellent. So people can find out more about that. We're going to give the website in a couple of minutes. I didn't know they had tortillas in Russia.
There's tortillas everywhere you go. They're just not called tortillas.
But that's one of the story that's sort of universal and has the universal trickster character in it and all
that's
of that.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
So how do you get young people involved in Teatro Paraguas to be the next generation of actors doing this?
As they look at me. Well, I've been working with children forever in Santa Fe, for a very long time. I'm with Rebecca Morgan with the Southwest Children's Theater. Which is the longest-running children's theater in Santa Fe. Over 20 years now, I had to give her a little. Because the kids do come from her training. I've worked with them before. And they've expressed interest, and especially the natives of Santa Fe, the kids that are natives, in being part of our company. And how did they get started? In one of the cuentos, in La Culebra. Mm-hmm. We had one of our first cuentos. We said, well, let's use children. Let's use children. It'll be really fun. So I said, well, I think I know a few kids that might be involved and that would like to do this. And they sure enough were. And they are now our A-team. There's about five or six or seven of them now. And so we have our young adults. And they especially love the cuentos. And they're learning everything they can behind the scenes, in festivals and makeup and everything. And they're just wonderful.
And speaking fluent Spanish on stage.
Yes, they are. They're speaking Spanish.
Yep.
Now, Mary, you are not only a founding member of Teatro Paraguas, but also an actor, director, writer, and poet yourself. How did you get involved in all this?
Well, we founded the company in 2004, and the first piece we did was a dual one-acts. Argos directed a piece called Fortunato, and I directed a piece which I adapted from a short story written by a local writer called The Ballad of Susio's Frog.
That's right.
And that is... was seen at that time by one of the programmers from the National Hispanic Cultural Center. So they would like us to perform it there, and we'll be doing it in February with a larger cast, and we're going to incorporate the kids. And it's a great story about a campesino from down in Hatch, who has a big chili field. He has a big field. And his mojados are coming across the river and stealing stuff from his field. So he's decided the best way to handle that is to go and find his friend who has four PhDs and get him to find a geneticist who can make him a gigantic frog with teeth that will scare off anybody from stealing from his field. And that's all well and good until the frog eats an FBI agent.
And there the fun begins.
And there the fun begins.
It's a very fun show.
It is indeed.
With puppets, a gigantic frog in it, and yeah. So
all of this is happening at Teatro Paraguas, and we would be remiss if we didn't mention that the Angel Gonzalez poetry event is going to be happening this coming weekend in Albuquerque at the National Hispanic Cultural Center on Saturday at 7:30 and on Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. So, and all of these the poetry reading is free. Now, let's talk about the new space for a moment here in Santa Fe. It's at 3221 B Richards Lane. So that must be off of Richards Avenue?
Richards Avenue when it turns into Henry Lynch Road.
Right, so not down where the Santa Fe Community College is. Oh, no, because if you go down there, you'll never find it.
Exactly.
It's off of Cerrillos Road.
Or off of Agua Fria.
Or off of Agua
Fria.
Between
Rufina.
Yes.
And what's there now? I mean, if this is a new space, I imagine that there's dusty spider webs and a lot of gray cement.
Well, I think we got rid of the spider webs.
We did. It already looks like a theater.
We've got a light grid. A light grid's up. Argos built a beautiful stage. We had a good team come in and get the light grid, and we're about ready to go. In fact, we have another show coming up where some artists will be doing their show in our space. And that should be interesting. It's called At the Edge of the Village, which will be a multimedia piece with three dancers who will be doing poetry and interpretive work. That should be really good.
They were also involved in the Violeta Parra show.
Violeta Parra show. Some of our members.
And that will be the last weekend of October. Around Halloween.
Halloween weekend and the next weekend. So six shows. That'll be six shows.
Wow, I didn't realize we had all this going on.
And we will, of course, announce all of these events here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. If you want to find out more about Teatro Paraguas, you can go to teatroparaguas.org. And if you can't spell it, go to my website, santafe.radiocafe.org, and I will link straight to it. Argos McCallum, Jojo Senna de Tarnoff, and Mary Meir, thank you all so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gracias.
Quite a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, good morning, jazz.